Hello, and welcome to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I prefer to think of it, Dear John and Hank.
It's a comedy podcast in which two brothers answer your dubious questions. Nope, answer your question, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon. John, what is the elephant in the room?
I just want to say for the record that we will be answering some dubious questions in this episode.
Yeah, no, we usually do.
We usually you weren't do. Totally
sometimes,
wrong.
Sometimes I'm like, I don't know that this question is asking from the perspective of a real situation or one that was just made up. But either way, I'm going to do it because it's a good question. All right. What's the elephant in the room, John?
3, 2, 1.
Walt Disney's signature. Reviewed.
Wait, what?
Walt Disney's signature?
Hank just made a video about Walt Disney's signature that is much better than it has any right to be. It is a really fascinating video. And actually, Hank, this is as close as we've ever come to having the same elephant in the room because I felt like that was your version of the Anthropocene Reviewed.
It was a little bit of an episode of the Anthropocene Reviewed in 5 minutes with lots of graphics. I had a really good time doing it, and but have not stopped being obsessed with it. I did not get to the bottom of it, and I have been, since the video has come out, some people have given me more information, and I have started to be really interested in talking to some people who are in their mid to late 80s, because I need to talk to them now before all the good information they have is gone.
Hank is going to get to the bottom of how the D in the Walt Disney logo came to be if it is the last thing he ever does. And it may be. It may well be the last thing he ever does.
Just working it. I'm working hard. And your elephant in the room is your own podcast. I mean, why not, John? Why not?
Well, yours is your own most recent video, so I'm not going to apologize. There is a new episode of the Anthropocene Reviewed that just came out. We're taking a break after this episode, so go listen to this one now because there won't be a new one for a while. The most recent one is about a 17,000-year-old cave painting of a hand stencil and the Taco Bell breakfast menu.
Did you have a good VidCon, John?
I did. I had a very nice VidCon. I really enjoyed myself. It was really lovely, and I thought in many ways it was the best VidCon ever, and I'm hugely grateful to the team who put it on and worked so hard to make sure that it was a safe, fun event.
You know, it occurs to me that we sure did make this whole intro with in mind the fact that now is now, when in fact this episode may come out in months.
Well, but the new episode of the Anthropocene Reviewed will be the new episode of the Anthropocene Reviewed for like a couple months.
Okay. We don't know when this one's going to come out because we recorded two this week because I assume we're going to be busy doing something and somebody decided to schedule us for two podcasts.
I'm going on vacation. This first question comes from Kelly, who writes, Dear John and Hank, have either of you ever gone for a high five where the person you tried to high five didn't reciprocate or didn't realize what was happening and left you hanging? I always have so much anxiety about this to the point where I don't even go for high fives anymore since the stakes and my hands are often too high. That's great.
Good.
Very well written, Kelly. Do you have any advice on what to do with my hands if I find myself in a non-reciprocal high five humiliation situation, or am I doomed to remain hanging? High fives, Kelly.
This happened to me at VidCon at least one time.
Yeah.
What I did was I went too high, just as Kelly said, and people were confused by what I was doing, and they were like, that looks like not the thing you should do.
Are you raising your hand? Would you like to be called upon?
Yeah. And then I was like, no, high five me. And so I like, which was not the most elegant solution to be like, is anybody going to do the thing? Because I'm sitting here and I can't. It's opening yourself up to a certain amount of vulnerability. And when you're in that situation saying like, high five me, dang it, is, I think, okay. And I think that that's showing like a certain amount of confidence.
No, because what if somebody doesn't like applying their palm microbes to your palm microbes? I don't want to put anybody under pressure to exchange palm microbes.
Well, because we know that the hands, everybody knows, Hank. Any initiation of a high five is putting people into that pressure. So what you just said is no one will ever high five again.
Well, I'm not saying no one should ever high five again. I'm just saying the hands are overwhelmingly the filthiest part of the body.
You could you could, I'm up here for a high five, and then you go, elbows, and I'm like, yeah, elbows, any recognition.
Or the fist bump that Howie Mandel does. I'm a big fan of the Howie right. Mandel fist bump. Mm-hmm. I actually have a solution to this problem, Hank. I saw it happen live in an NBA game, and it was one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen. You know how after a free throw, a lot of times, like, the players high five regardless of whether they make the free throw, just as a way of kind of, you know, just ritualizing the process in an attempt to make free throws work better?
No, I so, don't, but I
okay, well,
you.
That's a thing. There's a lot of high-fiving after free throws. That's all you need to know for this. this one time I saw a player, like, went for a high five just as all the other players, like, turned around and was left just holding his hand up. And what he did, I thought this was brilliant, was he brought his other hand up and he high-fived himself. And then he put both his hands down and he just, he was like, I got you. It's a wonderful example of self-care, and it's a wonderful example of, like, positive self-talk. Like, they don't want to high-five you? Well, I know somebody who does, buddy. It's yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I had that a similar thought, which is, like, you're up there, you're hanging, just fist pump.
Yeah, that also works. Just be like, woohoo!
Douche! This next question comes from Francisco, who asks, Dear Hank and John, my wife and I recently moved to a new state for work opportunities. I have made a good impression on my boss and have been entrusted to house sit while he and his family go to Australia for 2 weeks, I assume for VidCon Australia. We're 5 days in and my wife has locked us out. The neighbor, who supposedly had a spare key, informed us that they never received a key.
Oh, no.
Help! Love the podcast. Sincerely, Sad Francisco. Well, I assume that you've been sleeping out on the rocks in the front yard, because I think that they have xeriscaping, not a lawn, because these people are very respectful of the water situation wherever you live. And so you've been sleeping on the rocks waiting for this podcast to come out, which I appreciate greatly.
I don't know if I've ever told you this before, Hank, but this happened to a friend of mine, but it happened immediately after their 3-year-old son closed the door.
Oh, God.
And so they went to open the door and they realized that the door had locked behind the kid.
Oh,
and then
God.
For like 5 minutes, they watched the kid just, like, you know, live in complete freedom. And so, like, the kid walked to the refrigerator and, like, opened the refrigerator door and, like, rummaged around and didn't close it. And the whole time,
like,
they were like,
Jeffrey,
hey,
Jeffrey, Jeffrey,
Jeff,
Jeffrey,
Jeffrey,
Jeffrey, Jeffrey,
Jeffrey, open the
door,
turn the knob. And, like, the kid couldn't. But then, of course, like, the kid freaked out, you know, mm-hmm. like, it's like fine for 5 minutes. And then it's a complete freak out situation. And in the end, they had to take off their shirt, wrap it around their fist and punch a hole in their glass door in order to get back inside because they couldn't bear to wait for a locksmith. So the situation isn't that bad, hopefully.
Yeah.
Ideally, you just call a locksmith and you're like, listen, I don't own this home, but the owners are in Australia and trust me, it's cool.
Yeah, yeah. I swear you're not breaking into this very nice house just for
right.
me.
It's
I swear,
true
I promise.
That I,
it's absolutely.
Yeah, I promise.
I've been in a similar situation where I was asked to cat sit and needed to break into a house because the place, they had not left the key where they said they were going to leave the key and there was no key. And luckily, one of the windows was open and I just cut through the screen and snuck in that way.
Wow.
But if there's no way in, you gotta either locksmith, you gotta break a window, man.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but I don't see another solution unless.
Have you tried the chimney?
Don't try the chimney. Good God almighty. What a terrible idea.
I mean, this is the thing. Houses are built to not get broken into. Like, it's the whole point.
Right.
Not the whole point. There's, like, also you keep the rain off and stuff. But in general, people like to make their houses difficult to enter if you would not like other people to enter them.
This next question comes from Jess, who asks, Dear John and Hank, when I was in college, an upperclassman showed me a Tumblr blog she ran about a mutual friend. Let's call him Ian. In it, she and some of her friends basically talked about Ian like he was a fandom. They would write posts on why Ian is awesome, discuss which girls they shipped him with, etc.
Oh, wow.
It was a little odd, but overall the blog was mostly harmless. However, about a year after learning about this blog, I started dating Ian. We've been together for several years now. The problem is, I've never told Ian about this Tumblr. Should I? On one hand, there hasn't been a post on it in years, and neither Ian nor I have kept in contact with the girls who ran this blog. On the other hand, I'm not sure how Ian would respond to learning that such a thing exists and that I've been keeping it from him for so long. Marriage feels like it might be in the cards for us.
Oh, wow.
So should I just keep this secret from him for the rest of our lives? And if I did tell him, how would I even bring it up? Any dubious advice would be appreciated. Infinite Jess.
Oh, nicely done, Infinite Jess. Okay, John, I have a very specific set of feelings about this. This blog was not about Ian.
Correct.
This blog was about the idea of Ian. It was about, like, they had, like, you create mythologies around people when you're in social spaces.
Yeah.
I did this in high school all the time where there were people who, like, I saw peripherally and saw from a distance, and, like, my friends and I would make up, like, whole stories about their lives that weren't true, and we knew they weren't true. This blog is not about Ian. You know who Ian is. They did not know who Ian is. You do not have to tell Ian about this, but 10 years into your marriage, that's when you tell Ian.
No. Like, I have a 10-year anniversary present for you. There's something I've been hiding for the last 20 years.
15 years.
I also had something like this in high school. There was this kid who went to our high school, and everybody really loved him. He was a great guy, and people made stickers. You remember that Andre the Giant has a posse sticker that was popular in the early 90s? Mm-hmm. We made stickers of this guy, and then we put them all over the world, actually.
Oh,
like,
man.
Even
look at how, man, what would it be like to be, well, I guess you know now, because people do put your stickers in places.
Do they?
Yeah, there's a bunch of Pizza John stickers in the pizza restaurant by my office.
I guess there are Pizza John stickers out there. And the answer to what is it like is, it's pretty weird. But I also
But what would it be like to be a high school student and have people like you that
well,
much?
Well, I think the big difference was that I still think I get like 50 cents for every Pizza John sticker that gets sold, whereas I don't think this kid ever made a dollar. And I highly doubt that Ian was paid for his likeness on this Tumblr. my feeling about it is that it's fine to keep it a secret because it's not about Ian. But it's also fine to tell him. I don't think that he'll be like shocked or freaked out. I think he'll be like, oh, that's weird and not about me.
Right. It probably is the sort of thing to have come up rather than something to bring up. Because if you bring it up, it sounds like it's a big deal. And I don't think it is.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't think it's a big deal.
It would be a big deal if it were like some bullying burn book thing. But it's not.
Yeah,
it was
like
Ian is awesome, and we have made up a whole mythology around Ian and all the great things that Ian is. And then it turns out that Ian is awesome. So no worries.
Right, but also normal. Also a normal
guy. We don't
know
that for sure. At no point in Jess's letter does she say that Ian is not an amazing, amazing person who deserves to have many Tumblrs written about him.
All right, Jess, I'm going to hold you accountable now and say we should find out more about Ian. I need to know everything.
I do need to know everything, Jess. I want you to write me a book-length introduction to Ian.
Okay. It's official. John asked for that.
No, actually, I'm going to take that back. I don't want more than 200 words, but I want it to be extremely comprehensive.
That sounds more like it. This next question comes from Paula, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, I just started a job, a new adulty job, right out of college on the fifth floor of an office building. I love it, but there's a problem. The elevator in the office building is extremely slow. Because of this, I have to stand awkwardly next to people I don't know for minutes."
Mm.
That is a slow elevator.
Yeah.
What makes it worse is that there is no elevator music, so we stand there in silence. Is there something I should do to make the elevator ride less awkward? Should I make small talk with the office mates, even though I never see them outside of the elevator? Help me. If I could, I'd climb up the walla, Paula.
Very good, Paula.
Well, I mean, you could climb up the stairs, huh?
Yeah, that was going to be my suggestion as well. Have you considered the stairs, huh? Because the great thing about the stairs is that you get a fair amount of exercise and you don't have to encounter strangers. Or if you do encounter them, it's in a weird situation where you're sort of out of breath, so you're not expected to speak.
Right. This is like a legitimate thing that I want to point out. As someone who climbs stairs every day at the office or at my house, I'm like, stairs are no big deal. And then when I hit like the third flight, if I'm in a hotel or in the convention center or something, I'm like, okay, that's not nothing.
Yeah.
Like, I'm doing this still. So five floors is a lot. Like, it's not, like, I'm not saying you should be able to tell, but a month into this, it won't be a big deal, and it'll be faster than this slow as everything elevator. The only other alternative, I think, is to, on your cell phone, play Kesha's Woman, every time you get into the elevator.
Oh, or any song, really, because then you're just, then you get known at the office as the person who plays elevator music for us. But it's always
but
the same
song. But I think whatever
song.
It is, it should be the same song every day.
Hank, let's throw out some songs that would be good songs for Paula to play every single day on her five-minute elevator ride in the morning.
Margaritaville.
Really solid. I'm a Believer by the Monkees.
Sweet Home Alabama.
Very specific. And
I don't know where the office building is.
I mean, it's much better if it's in Maine than if it's in Alabama.
Yeah.
Mo Money, Mo Problems by Notorious B.I.G.
Living on a Prayer by Bon Jovi.
Very good. That might be the best. We might be done now. That's it. It's Living on a Prayer by Bon Jovi, Paula. Every single day, walk into that elevator and then just the booming noise of Bon Jovi.
It's because you are. You're halfway there. You're on your way up. It probably by the time you get to that part of the song, you're halfway there.
Right, exactly. The best part about Living on a Prayer is that it like begins with that like thumping drum beat.
So, yeah, that stuff.
Like the moment the elevator closes, it's just like. All right, Hank, I'm just going to play it for you. Actually, it's coming. Hold on. Hold on. Wait for it.
Oh, does that have a. Yeah.
Right as the door closes.
And everybody's like, well, great. I guess we're doing this now.
Day 672 of taking the elevator with Paula.
That's turned out better than expected.
I haven't had so much fun on Dear Hank and John since we found out about Ross Baghdadian Jr. and the Chipmunks.
John, do you know that song? Do you know what a double dactyl is?
I don't know what a double dactyl is. Is it a kind of dinosaur?
It's a rhyme scheme.
Oh,
it's a rhyme scheme that tends to be used just in poetry, but Living on the Prayer actually has uses double dactyls.
Do you know that Living on a Prayer was on the Bon Jovi album Slippery When Wet, which was the first cassette tape I ever owned? It was my third favorite song on Slippery When Wet, behind my favorite song when I was 9 years old, Wanted Dead or Alive.
Oh man,
and
wow.
My second favorite song,
you know, 9-year-olds,
You Give Love a Bad Name.
That song was great. I love that song.
I did not understand the theme of in third grade when I first listened to that album.
I imagine you also did not understand the theme of Slippery When Wet, the name of the album.
In fact, I did not understand it until just now when you said it.
I apologize.
I want to go back in time to when I thought it was a reference to recently washed floors.
No, it's because he gets so sweaty on stage. Next question.
Great. Moving on. I mean, it was so good until it all went bad. Oh, dear John and Hank, this question is from Hannah. Dear John and Hank, as I was strolling around the streets of San Francisco, I realized something that puzzled me. When you press that little button that says something along the lines of press to walk, it doesn't seem to hurry up the process of changing the green light to red for pedestrians. Then I thought that maybe the number of people that press the button tells the machines if they can change the light, but even if no one presses the button, it still changes. What is the point of this button? Dubious answers are appreciated. Hannah.
Sure, like here's just a straight up. We had a bunch of fun just now, so we're going to have straight up answers. They do different things in different places.
Oh.
In some places, it's purely psychological. It's like, if there's not a button, people are like, when is the light going to change for me? And so they just put a button there and it doesn't do anything.
Like the closed door button in almost every elevator.
Except in Europe, where I found out that you actually oftentimes have to push the closed door button, which was a very huge surprise for me. And I was sitting there in the elevator being like, why am I not going anywhere? Anyway, there are also some buttons that are there for vision impaired people. So you push the button and it will tell you, it will give you updates on the situation. Mm-hmm. It will tell you to wait or to walk.
Right.
There are also buttons that actually do have an impact. And those are at intersections where the light doesn't change unless a car pulls up or unless somebody pushes the button. And in that case, oftentimes the button push will give you a longer light cycle, a longer green for the cars going through the light, and also you get that walk time where you, instead, if you didn't push the button, you'd have a very quick green for just the cars that would not be quick enough for pedestrians.
So in short, it's just like life. Sometimes you press a button and it matters, and other times you press a button and it doesn't matter, and you press the button the same way regardless, and
yeah,
you never know.
You just sort of do what the Panopticon is telling you to do.
Okay. Hank, did you know that Slippery When Wet, the Bon Jovi album, I'm sorry to return to it, but I'm not done yet, sold 3.4 million digital copies? Like, once digital music became a thing, enough people still love Slippery When Wet to buy 3.4 million digital copies of it.
I mean, and I assume that people had already purchased a tape and possibly a record and possibly a CD, and then this is like the fourth time they're buying Slippery When Wet.
Yeah.
It's so good that we have moved past this era. We don't have to do this anymore. We just pay our $10 a month for Google Play Music or whatever, YouTube Music, or Spotify.
It's good for us. I don't know that it's good for John Bon Jovi and Richie Sambora, hardworking members of Bon Jovi.
John, actually, did you know that Richie Sambora, I have terrible news for you, is not a member of John Bon Jovi's band anymore?
Shut the front door. Are you serious?
It had to happen sometime. Creative differences, I'm sure.
Oh my God, he left the band in 2013. How am I just hearing this breaking news?
Well, I also didn't. I just found out myself, I have to admit.
Hank, we have another question. This one comes from Troy. And by the way, if we sound different, that's because it's a week and a half later.
John's memory card got corrupted, so we had half a podcast, and now we are cutting in the second half of the podcast.
It's true that my memory card got corrupted, but just for the record, it is not because I ate the memory card, which is what happened right the last time my memory card got corrupted. So in a way, this is progress. This was just an old-fashioned technological failure, not me trying to eat a pretzel chip that turned out to be a memory card. This next question comes from Troy, who writes, "Hello." That's how the email begins. "I work as a bookkeeper for a very well-off small business and have been for the past 2 years. I thought my wage was pretty decent given that I don't work many hours, but recently the owner has gotten me to add his wife to the payroll, and her pay is much higher than mine. I asked what exactly she was doing, as I have never seen her around the office, and he said that she was going to take over some of the audit work he does, which is very little and not worth the pay that she's getting." Oh, Troy, this has nothing to do with value and everything to do with taxes. "Basically, is it right for me to negotiate a higher wage and use another employee's rate of pay as an argument to increase mine since I do the payroll and what everyone else makes, or is it wrong since that kind of information is supposed to be confidential? I haven't fallen yet, Troy."
Oh, good name specific sign off. Yeah, John is right that this is all about tax loopholes, and it is a little bit. I don't know how above board it all is.
It's very common. It's very common for businesses that are owned by one person or by a couple to put both people in the couple on the payroll as a way of shifting.
There's a bunch
tax
of advantages.
Burdens.
Yeah, there's a bunch of advantages, and also like you can put more into your retirement accounts and all this stuff. But yeah. It is a very, very common thing to do.
I would argue, though, that it doesn't have anything to do with the value of your work, Troy. And I don't think in general it's a good idea to use information that should be confidential to negotiate your salary. That said, if you do think that you deserve a higher salary, you should go and negotiate it. I think that I'm all for that. I think people should do that more often. I think if you add a lot of value to the company that you work for, go in and make the case.
Yeah, and the worst thing that can happen is that they'll be like, "Oh, in the situation we're in right now, we really don't want to do that. We're, you know," and then maybe you'll know a little bit more about how the company works, and hopefully everybody realizes that that's not an antagonistic experience. It is a, it's part of how businesses have to work.
Exactly.
This next question comes from Nicole, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, it's currently the day before my birthday, and I had walked into work to see gifts from my coworkers sitting on my desks. You have multiple desks. That's amazing. Wow. I politely thanked them, talked about my plans for my birthday, and then just went to work. I'm really happy they gave me something, but I have found myself in a dilemma. Should I open their gifts right away, or should people wait until they are in private to open gifts? I used to think it was disrespectful to open birthday gifts in front of people, but I don't want my coworkers to think I don't appreciate them. Please help as I sit awkwardly next to a small pile of birthday gifts, just short of a dime, Nicole.
Oh, that's good.
It's like nickel.
Oh, man.
It's like nickel.
I mean, the quality of the name-specific sign-offs on this podcast have never been higher.
Also, the quality of your workplace. Like, I feel like, is this a prank? Like, never have I ever been in a workplace where someone had a birthday and they received a small pile of gifts.
Yeah, me neither.
We're like, hey, maybe you'll get a cake. Maybe there will be a balloon. Maybe someone will bring in cookies.
When
but
I worked
really,
at
that's
Booklist,
just because we all want cookies.
When I worked at Booklist, the rule was that on your birthday, you had to bring in your own damn cake.
Really?
Yeah, because otherwise you got to remember when everybody's birthday is. So you get just as much cake, but it's the responsibility of the birthday owner to bring in the cake. I thought it was a great solution. Anyway, you are not under any responsibility whatsoever to open up these presents during work hours. As a business owner, I feel very strongly about that. No, you open them up afterwards and then you send notes. Yeah. You send thank you notes so that people know that you appreciated the gifts.
I mean, it would be a very, I don't know where we are right now. I don't know. I'm completely in left field. I don't understand your workplace. I don't understand this. Like, we have a very supportive, tight-knit workplace, but this would never happen. And I can't imagine any situation that's not like a baby shower where an adult is surrounded by people as they open gifts. It's just like, it's super awkward. Surrounded by... Like that at a baby shower, it's like your closest friends. At work, it's like this is it. Like, okay, everybody stand around while I find out what kind of bobblehead or action figure I was given by Tony over in accounting. I don't know. What do you get from coworkers? Here's a can of LaCroix. I don't understand.
Hey, I got you a digital download of Slippery When Wet.
Good callback, John, to a week and a half ago.
Thank you. We should mention, by the way, Hank, that it's been a fascinating week and a half since we last recorded this podcast.
Surely has.
The biggest news by far, aside from the amazing, moving, tear-jerking rescue of the Wild Boars soccer team in Thailand, which is just beautiful and the best of humanity, and reminded me, actually, of your book, Hank, because your book also explores the way that how great humanity can be at its best. Aside from that, the big news, of course, this week is that I am now a character in the Marvel Cinematic Universe as a result of the appearance my book, The Fault in Our Stars, in Ant-Man and the Wasp, which I can only assume was a subtle and very generous apology for the fact that the first Ant-Man movie absolutely destroyed Paper Towns at the box office when they came out the same weekend.
I mean, it is Ant-Man. But, John, you made Ant-Man cry.
Yes, the eighth largest franchise in all of Marvel.
I mean, the eighth largest franchise in all of Marvel is still like, it's like the 10th largest franchise in all of everything.
That's true. That's a good point. And I should add that I'm very grateful to have become a character in the Marvel Cinematic Universe rather than in the DC Universe, which is right now my very least favorite universe. I mean,
oh man,
the things that are happening in the DC character universe, from Michael Cohen on down, continue to be fascinating, but not in a way that I want to be part of.
I think that we are in a transitionary moment where we do not know what to do with the tools that we have, but eventually when we figure it out, things will be okay. Right, John?
I mean, silver was very bad short-term news for the world in the 17th century, and I guess it got better. Today's podcast is brought to you by Twitter. Twitter, I guess it will get better.
This podcast is also brought to you by the Book of Ian. The Book of Ian. It's a book about everything to do with Ian.
Don't share it with Ian, please. And of course, today's podcast is also brought to you by the Cell 5. The Cell 5. Why high-five someone else when you have your own microbiome to high-five yourself with?
And also, this podcast is brought to you by Slippery When Wet. John hadn't thought about that one very hard, and now he has.
Oh, I just want to go back in time. to a more innocent age. Today's podcast is also brought to you by our real sponsor. Our real sponsor is Brilliant. You can go to brilliant.org/dearhank or brilliant.org/dearjohn. I recommend the latter.
And if you do that, you can sign up for free. And also the first 200 people that go to that link will get 20% off the annual premium subscription. And because learning stuff is one of the best ways to feel like you're progressing as a person. And research seems to indicate that one of the ways we feel good and feel valuable is by moving through a process of mastery, whether that's cooking or playing piano or learning Spanish or probability or logic or complex algebra, physics, astronomy or machine learning or any other dozens of things that you can learn at brilliant.org.
Hank, all we have in life is our attention. It is the only resource that we have in the end. And one of the things I like about Brilliant is that it calls me to use my attention a little more carefully and a little more thoughtfully to better understand the universe and my place in it. And I really like it. And I encourage everybody to check it out. You just go to brilliant.org. That's where you check it out. But if you want to help our podcast, you can go to brilliant.org/dearjohn or brilliant.org/dearhank.
You get the first 200 people get 20% off the annual premium subscription. John.
Yes.
We have another question.
Great.
It's from Mindy, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, I need your help. I am so confused about football scarves.
Yeah.
Why are the scarves so short?" I feel like you know the answer to this question. You must know the answer to this question, John. "I would like to support our new Minnesota United team. Go Loons!" That's adorable. "And the marketing suggests that I should get a scarf. But when I look at football scarves, they seem really short. As a knitter and a person who lives in a cold place, I believe that a scarf should be nearly as long as the wearer is tall, which allows for adequate coverage of the face and neck and head. Football scarves aren't anywhere close to this. Why? Nanu nanu, Mindy."
So, Mindy, great reference to a sitcom that nobody listening to this has ever seen. Hank, before we get to the issue of soccer scarves, Nanu okay. Nanu reminded me of old comedians, which reminded me that last weekend I saw Yakov Smirnoff live in concert in Branson, Missouri at the Yakov Smirnoff Theater in Branson.
Wait, there's a Yakov Smirnoff Theater?
Correct.
Does he have like a standing engagement?
Many years. He had a standing engagement there for like 25 years. For those of you unfamiliar with Yakov Smirnoff, he is a Russian-American comedian who came to the United States in, I think, 1977 from the Soviet Union, speaking no English whatsoever, and built a small empire around being this like Soviet dissident comedian. And his catchphrase was, "America, what a country." And he's very funny. And I have to say, today, Yakov Smirnoff is 67 years old. He's playing in Branson. I would say the median age for the Yakov Smirnoff show was 74. We were definitely the youngest people in the room, and it was great. He did a great job. He still has it. He told a lot of the old jokes. He told a lot of the new jokes, and I really enjoyed myself. I was a little dubious going in, but like I enjoyed myself so much, and it made me think so hard that there may be like a Yakov Smirnoff review in the Anthropocene Reviewed at some point. That's how much I liked it, and that's how interesting I found it. Anyway, to get back to your question, Mindy, the reason
that was it? That was the whole thing?
That's it. I just wanted to tell you that. Hank, a lot has happened in the last week and a half, and I want to bring you up to date.
I like that a lot, and I would like to interview Yakov Smirnoff and be like, what's it been like to go to do the thing you did? Because
yeah.
I want to know how to transition. You got to have so many transitions in a career as a person who is in the public eye, and I need to know how to do that because I feel as if I have experienced some already, and they come with difficulties.
Yeah, Hank and I are deeply, deeply interested on how people deal with being on what I call the other side of the mountain. Like, when you're on your way down the other side of the mountain, how do you make it fun and meaningful? One of the ways that I make it fun and meaningful, Hank, just to give you a piece of advice, is I remind myself that there were lots of things that I did not like about the previous side of the mountain.
It's true. It's true.
Anyway, to get back to your question, Mindy, which was about football scarves. The reason is that most football teams do not play in Minnesota, and most right. people do not need scarves that are as long as the person is tall. So I think there's two reasons for this. One is that, you know, in England and France and other places where football started in the early 20th century, shorter scarves made sense because they were cheaper to make, they required less stuff, and they were adequate for the covering of the neck. And then the second reason is that the football scarf is partially intended as a thing that you hold up above your head, and it needs right. to be the approximate width of your arms when they are held above your head in a Y, like you're doing the beginning of the YMCA in the Village People song.
Right.
And so that is the proper length for a football scarf. And I know that it isn't great in Minnesota, but you've got to remember, most of us aren't in Minnesota.
So when you're at a football game and you have your football scarf, are you wearing your football scarf like a scarf, or is it just like sitting on your lap getting ready for you to shake it?
Oh, I think if it's cold, you're definitely wearing it as a scarf. And then if you're not wearing it,
is it just like draped over? Like, is it just draped or is it wrapped?
I drape it unless it's properly cold, and then I wrap it.
Okay. So here's the situation, yeah. Mindy. You need two scarves. You need a regular, normal scarf, of yep. which you appear to probably have plenty because yep. you're a knitter and also you live in Minnesota. And then around, like, you've got your scarf on, and then you have your football scarf that just drapes across. It's like wearing a pin that says, like, I like the loons, but it says scarf. And it's like, it's there to let people know, and it is a purely decorative scarf, it appears.
I think that's a good way to think about it, Hank. Just double scarf the situation. Nobody in Minnesota ever regretted having a second scarf in winter.
Absolutely. Yes. Have two scarves. You're not going to complain about having another piece of fabric. But, John, business idea, really long scarves for the Minnesota United team. It's like you and I. We're gonna make dozens of dollars.
It's not the worst business idea you've had in the last week and a half, but it's I was gonna say, but it's also not the best. But actually, it is the best. All right, Hank, this next question comes from Tristan, who writes, Dear John and Hank, but mostly Hank, I discovered Brotherhood 2.0 through EcoGeek a very long time ago.
Oh, my.
Wow, a very long time ago, back in 2007. Thank you for sticking with us all this time, Tristan. Every now and then I check in on EcoGeek to see if it has been updated. The last two updates are both in January of 2017 and 2018, respectively. After the name Yeek. Change to Complexly for your company, I figured EcoGeek would fully die, but what is it with this weird zombie state for something that you used to care so much about? P&P, Tristan. Parties and Peppers.
Pumpkins and Penguins, Pride and Prejudice. It's what I always think when somebody puts P&P. When I transitioned out from being somebody who was working day to day on EcoGeek because the videos things had taken over so much. That was in part because, like, I had so much stuff to do. It was also in part because, like, I wasn't as enthusiastic about that project anymore because blogging was changing and there was a lot of consolidation going on and people and it was sort of like I would either have to make EcoGeek a blog on a bigger network or I was gonna have to not do it anymore. And also, like, I was kind of the way to get people to click on articles felt, it was just too much clickbait for me to make it feel valuable. So there were things I actually didn't like about it. So I kind of gave it over to some of the other writers and I was like, keep this up if and when you want to. And it is still really remarkable to see it there. And also that, like, the design of EcoGeek hasn't, you know, 10 years later looks not super stale, which is
yeah, but I think
great.
That's mostly because the internet has come all the way back around, like how right, bell bottoms right. are back. Like, for a while it did look stale, but now, like, we're back to white, mostly empty pages, and I'm like, EcoGeek looks pretty good these days.
Oh man. Well, I yeah, and I think that's largely the situation. And also in general, like, you gotta, like, there are parts of life that will come and go, and it still exists, though, because a part of me is always like, we should be doing something with this. There should be an EcoGeek YouTube channel or something. Because I still do. Obviously, I care a lot about the topic still.
Yeah, my feeling has always been that some things on the internet end some ways and other things end other ways. And it's like life. Sometimes it goes out with a bang and sometimes with a whimper. And I don't mind things continuing to be there and to live in small ways. I know, I understand the urge to want closure or to want an ending for things, but I guess one of the things I like about the internet is that things often don't end in that straightforward way. That feels more true to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hank, before we get to the all-important news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon, I want to ask you one last question. It's from Megan. It's a big one. It's complicated. It's hard to get into, but it's also a beautiful question. Dear John and Hank, who is Mr. Rogers? Megan.
Oh, no.
I know.
Well,
but if you're a young person, you might not know who Mr. Rogers is, except insofar as all the kindnesses that your parents have ever shown you come directly from Mr. Rogers.
There we have a little book that sits on our downstairs toilet. It's just a bunch of Mr. Rogers quotes. And if you should get that book and just have it on your toilet, because it's way better than looking at Twitter while you're going to the bathroom.
there's also a great Mr. Rogers documentary that's just come out that's really, really powerful and moving and kind of a balm in these times. Mr. Rogers was a children's television host on public television who also was a source of kindness in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a really thoughtful, empathetic person. I don't know how he happened, but it's marvelous that he did, because I know even now, like, we are starting to watch Mr. Rogers with Oren, though of course he doesn't get what's happening most of the time. But, like, Catherine and I are like, this is great. Thank you, Mr. Rogers. I feel better about stuff. And also, like, that was some good advice. And I'm like, this is for children. But I need this right now. Not like I need it, like, to balm my soul. Like, I need this advice.
Right. No, I completely agree. I mean, Mr. Rogers remains extremely relevant. I do think that in our secular world, one of the things that we need that we are struggling to find or haven't quite found yet is a version of sainthood. And obviously saints are not perfect people, and Mr. Rogers was not a perfect person, but if you're going to have a saint, I think you could do worse.
Yeah. I mean, it is nice to have people that you can definitely look up to.
Can I tell you a Mr. Rogers story, Hank?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mr. Rogers worked in Pittsburgh. And
is it about the car that got stolen?
It is.
You told that story on the podcast before.
Can I tell you a Mr. Rogers story, Hank?
Yeah.
This is a different one. So Mr. Rogers worked and lived in Pittsburgh. That's where they made the show. And the Fault in Our Stars movie was filmed in Pittsburgh. And Mr. McFeely from the show, remember Mr. McFeely, the male guy?
Oh, of course.
Mr. McFeely happened to find out that we were filming The Fault in Our Stars, and I don't know if it was him or his nephews and nieces or kids or grand or what. Somebody was a fan of The Fault in Our Stars, and Mr. McFeely came to The Fault in Our Stars set and was so kind and lovely and wonderful to us, and gave us all this Mr. Rogers stuff for our kids and Daniel Tiger, which is the show that Mr. Rogers Studios makes now. And we, you know, have, like, being able to take that stuff home to my kids was such a wonderful memory. And it was just a wonderful little tiny thing. Sometimes people can do little tiny things that, you know, make a big impact on your life. So thank you to Mr. McFeely, and thank you to Mr. Rogers. And now, Hank, now it is time for the news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon.
I can't believe you met Mr. McFeely.
Oh, he was so nice, too.
Man. That's...
Is that like the coolest celebrity encounter I've ever had?
I mean, honestly, maybe?
No. For me, it was meeting Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
You met Dwayne The Rock Johnson?
He handed me an MTV Movie Award, not to brag.
That's not really a meeting.
I mean, I saw his bicep up real close.
My eyes were maybe
4 to 5 inches away from his bicep.
Is he a tall guy?
I don't know if he's a tall guy or I was just hunched over real bad because I was nervous. could have been either.
Well, let's look. He's 6'5". Guess is he's pretty tall.
He's tall. He's 6'5".
Your eyes are about level with his biceps.
Also, you got to remember his biceps go like all the way up to his shoulder.
You know what's real weird to me that I did have a hard time sort of processing?
Yep.
That Hulk Hogan is 6'7".
I would have a hard time processing that, except I once was on a plane with Hulk Hogan, so I know exactly how tall he is. Have I never told you this story?
You meet too many people.
I've seen almost every celebrity on a plane. Every celebrity who travels via commercial aircraft, I have been on a plane with. So Hulk Hogan, I was on a plane with Hulk Hogan. I was seated in coach and he was seated in first class. But he stood for the entire flight. Like the moment the fasten seatbelt sign went off, he stood up and he stood facing the rest of the plane, just like staring out at us. And the most amazing detail, Hank, is that
this is a great story.
Unlike most celebrities, he was dressed precisely as Hulk Hogan. Like he was not wearing sunglasses. He was not trying to disguise himself in any way. He was like, yes, it is Hulk Hogan on your plane. Me, Hulk Hogan, staring at you for the next hour and 15 minutes.
Well, when you're 6'7", you don't want to sit down. You want to stand up.
You know the celebrity I've been on a plane with most often?
Oh my, is it John Green? What's happening right now?
It's Snoop Dogg. I've been on a plane with Snoop Dogg 4 times.
What?
4 times.
At that point, you're just like, okay, I guess we're friends, right?
I met Snoop backstage at a thing once, and we took a picture together because I guess his kids like my books or whatever, and he was very nice, and everyone I've talked to about Snoop, because I've sat next to his manager or people several times, they all speak highly of him. But he does a much better job of disguising himself than Hulk Hogan. That's all I'll say.
Ah, so maybe I have sat next to Snoop.
It's very possible. Very possible.
I think at some point we promised some people some Mars news, so I'm going to do that instead of, like, who's John been on a plane with before?
You guys can't wait for my new spinoff podcast, People I've Shared a Plane With.
So the news of Mars is, so there's a meteorite, a beautiful little meteorite. In fact, it's called Black Beauty. That's what they call it, the scientists, because it's a pretty little black meteorite that's from Mars. And this, you know, we have previous models of how Mars formed and when Mars first became sort of like the crust formed and then rain fell. So there's this, sort of this window between which, like, there was definitely liquid water on Mars and then it stopped being there. And then when it started being there is basically the moment when there was a crust. Mm-hmm. So that is the window during which life could have happened. And so knowing that those dates is important. And the models, the mathematical models we have for how Mars would have formed, indicates that the crust formed pretty late, later than this new evidence is showing us. So instead of like 100 million years to before the crust formed, it would have been more like 20 million years, according to an analysis of this meteorite, which scientists did science to sort of like say like, okay, this. Rock is a very old rock from the surface of Mars, and we can tell from, I think, the zircon crystals in it that this rock formed just 20 million years after the formation of the solar system, rather than like 100 or 150 Wow. million years after the formation of the solar system, which was our previous guess. So that's pretty big news, and it has a pretty big impact on how we're imagining the sort of window of potential life on the surface of Mars.
That's really interesting. So is it possible that there was life on Mars like long before there was life on Earth?
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of that hypothesis is out there that like if there was, if we do find some evidence of former life on Mars, we'll be able to tell whether that life shares a common ancestry with us. Mm. So was that life... And if it doesn't, it will actually be really hard to figure out if it counts, because all the things we have to test for life are all based on our chemistry. But
but it, you know, like the idea that life could have gone from Earth to Mars, and that like all the Mars life just got knocked off of Earth on a meteorite, or that it came from Mars to Earth and we are in fact all descendants of Martian microbes.
Right.
Which would be really neat.
It would be amazing if after all of these decades of work to get humans to Mars, it turns out that we were Martians all along.
And if that is the case, John, question, does that mean we've already been to Mars so we got there before 2028?
If definitive proof is discovered that we are all Martians at some point before 2028 or after 2028, we will either continue to keep the podcast named Dear Hank and John, or we will change it back to
yes.
Dear Hank and John.
Yes, so there is a chance.
But I mean, I want proof. I don't mean like climate change is real proof. I mean proper proof. That was just to be very clear. That was a joke. That was a joke for Hank. That was a joke for Hank. And climate change is real. And that was the joke. Okay, the news from AFC Wimbledon. Hank, there is so much news from AFC Wimbledon. We've lost all of our players, and we've gained an entirely new set of players. We've played some friendly games at which these new players have had to encounter each other, presumably for the first time. Yesterday, Neil Ardley said that he is still trying to sign, wait for it, 7 more players.
Oh my goodness gracious.
The season starts in like a month. Neil Ardley would like to have at least 7 more signings for AFC Wimbledon this summer. So that is from South London Press and Mercury, which I think is South London's leading AFC Wimbledon newspaper. All right, so I just want to introduce you to some of our new players. First off, we have a new goalkeeper. It's a shame because I really liked George Long. He was great. But our new goalkeeper is named Tom King, which lends itself to lots of puns. So congratulations, Tom. He's excited to...
Okay.
I think he's on loan. He is on loan from Millwall. We've had a lot of players on loan from Millwall over the years. We've had a good relationship with Millwall. They've provided us with some of our best players, so I'm all for it. I'm excited about Tom King. We also have a new striker. His name is James Hansen, and he is a big, big lad. He's 30 years old. He's 6'4" tall, and in the past, AFC Wimbledon has done well when we've had huge strikers who are difficult to deal with, the most famous being, of course, Adebayo Akinfenwa, but there are lots of other examples as well. So that's exciting news. We got a new midfielder whose name is Mitch Pinnock. All I know is that on Twitter, he calls himself Mitchy Pins.
Really? That's...
Mitchy Pins.
That sounds a lot like something you'd make up.
I mean, I agree with you 100%. It does sound like something I would make up. But his name...
Is your phrase of the week Mitchy Pins?
Mitchy Pins. Anyway, I really hope he scores a lot of goals because I want to say the words Mitchy Pins all the time. I don't even know if it's good news or bad news, but that's his name, Mitchy Pins. And we also signed a player on loan named Tanai Watson, who is a defender who played for Reading. People are excited about him. Let's keep our fingers crossed, I guess. I have no idea if he's any good. He's young, and he looks driven based on the one picture of him that I've seen. So, yeah, that's the deal. We've got some new players. And there was also an interesting Meet the Manager event at which Neil Ardley was asked a bunch of questions about last season. And one of the things that he said is that he was upset that some kind of cliques formed and that he felt like the team wasn't on the same page and that some of the players who've been released or moved on, he felt like were maybe part of that problem. So now hopefully we'll have this sort of like unified squad who all buy into the plan. Our preseason results so far have been excellent. We beat Reading. Preseason, it doesn't really matter because a lot of times, you know, teams are starting not their best players to see who's good or who plays well together or whatever. But we beat Reading 4-2. And Joe Piggott scored a goal. Or as I call him, Joey Pigs. Kwesi Appiah also scored a goal. I can't think of Kwesi Apps. Get ready for this all season long. It's never going to stop. Every week, no matter who scores, I'm going to report on the exploits of Mitchy Pins, no matter what. Anyway, so that's the update. We've had a good preseason. Things seem to be going well, but it's entirely new players, so I don't know whether to be excited or terrified.
John, I think that you should be excited. You guys, all right. You guys are spending your cash, and I think you're doing it wisely. Now, it's time for the phrase of the week, which I can definitively say you didn't say because you said it last podcast, and I still know what it is.
What was it?
Something about treadmills.
It was treadmill shuffling, which was Camus' dance move. And I did say it last time, and I got away with it.
You did.
And it was incredibly impressive, but unfortunately, the memory card didn't work. So I apologize to Camus' signature dance move, who donated that for the Project for Awesome. And I, even though you did say your phrase of the week last time, I don't flip and remember it. What is it?
It's double dactyl from dactyl. Sierra.
So Sierra, and he did a
thank you. But I will say that I did not. That Slippery When Wet, or whatever song I was talking about back then, does not have double dactyls in it. And I lied to you, and it was very hard for me to keep lying to you. But I did that and powered through and didn't bring up the fact that I was lying, which was hard.
Right, so the double dactyl rhyme scheme does not appear in any song on Slippery When Wet, Bon Jovi's classic album. However, there is a double dactyl rhyme scheme example on Wikipedia involving our favorite president, Benjamin Harrison.
Wait, what?
Once said was boring, and I got in a lot of trouble for saying he was boring, so I'm going to read you this poem that I did not write. I did not write, and I do not agree with its theme. It is a poem by John Hollander. Higgledy Piggledy, Benjamin Harrison, 23rd president, was, and as such, served between Clevelands, and, save for this trivial idiosyncrasy, didn't do much.
Wow. 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 That is very weird. That is a very weird convergence of something dumb and silly and something dumb and silly suddenly having a large overlap on this podcast.
Speaking of which, we have a Project for Awesome message from Boyer to read to Jess. Boyer, thank you for donating to the Project for Awesome. Jess, this is your message. The post office isn't hiring in Fairbanks, so I guess you have to move back to Iowa now. Is that like a code? Did I just send
yeah, right?
The Russians a message from Donald Trump?
Don't use us this way. There's lots of ways to communicate on the internet now.
Seriously, Michael Cohen, what did I just tell that Russian pop star who organized the meeting at Trump Tower? Anyway, if you're a real person, Boyer and Jess, I hope that that message meant a lot to you. Or alternately, that the post office starts hiring in Fairbanks because it is a lovely town.
All right, John. Thank you for making a podcast with me. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this podcast, which is edited by Nicholas Jenkins. It's produced by Rosianna Hals-Rojas and Sheridan Gibson. Our head of community and communications is Victoria Bongiorno. The music that you're hearing right now and at the beginning of the podcast is from the great Gunnarola. And as they say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome.